Okay, so let us start again and see what happens. Lots of questions, that's good. So let's see how we go. Okay, you mentioned that the idea of consciousness being conditioned was uniquely Buddhist. Where then does the idea of chit-dharma, or mind essence, come from? I have heard of a few Buddhist teachers who advocate this mind essence business. Did Ajahn Chah also teach this? Is the chit-dharma idea like Advaita, when we let go of our sense of self, we merge with the universal consciousness? Also, could you please explain how the five khandhas relate to the six sense fields? I find this a bit confusing. Thanks. Okay, so the idea that consciousness is a phenomenon that is dependent on other things for its existence, I would say, is a uniquely Buddhist idea. And I don't think it exists anywhere else, because most ideas of spirituality have this idea that there is some essence inside of us which kind of exists on for ever and ever. The idea of the soul, the idea of Brahma, and all these kind of things. This is the usual way most spiritual teachings. And it kind of makes sense. You can see why people would think that, because in a lot of teachings where you have meditation practice and you have these things, people will often have a deep state of meditation. They will achieve some kind of samadhi. And when they see that samadhi, they will say, wow, I have achieved something extraordinary, something special. I have kind of found the meaning of life itself. And what they have found, and what they think they have found, and what seems is reasonable enough, is that they have found the kind of the permanent consciousness. That's what a deep state of samadhi can appear like. And especially if you have a view from your culture that reaffirms that idea, it's very hard to challenge it, right? It's very difficult, because you are conditioned to regard that state of samadhi in that particular way. So this is why the Buddhas, a Buddha is so rare in the world, because it is so counterintuitive to break through that and see things in a new way. But from the Buddhist point of view, this is the only way you can actually can make a final end of suffering, is actually by seeing that conditionality of consciousness itself. So the idea of chit-dharma, mind essence, yes, there are a few teachers who advocate that, and you have to ask them why they advocate this. Some of these will claim that Ajahn Chah also taught this. Others will claim that Ajahn Chah didn't teach this, right? There are people who will claim that Buddha taught this as well, if you read the suttas. So people have all kinds of different ideas of what Buddhism is about. But to me, it is, you know, the idea of kind of a mind essence is exactly the idea that the Buddha went against in Islam. That was the idea that existed in Brahmanical society at the time, in the Hindu society of India in those days. People had an idea of a mind which merges with the universal consciousness and all these kind of things. Brahma and Atta is the same. The world and the mind is the same. And it was precisely the thing that the Buddha, in a sense, saw what was actually not the reality. And I personally cannot understand how people can advocate this idea of chit-dharma, as I said. To me, it seems to make no sense whatsoever. And my conclusion is that anyone who advocates that, they haven't really seen the truth. That's my only possible conclusion. It may seem very arrogant, perhaps, on my part, but that is how I read the suttas, and I can only be honest to my own reading and understanding of the Buddha's teachings. Did Ajahn Chah teach this? I don't think so, but some people claim that he did. Is it like Advaita? Yes, it's probably very similar to the idea of Advaita Vedanta, which is the Hindu meditation ideas, where the word Advaita means non-duality. Dvaita is like twofold. Advaita, non-duality. This idea of merge, it's like samadhi, right? The same kind of thing. In Buddhist teaching, samadhi is really non-duality. It is actually called that in the suttas. It's called ekatta. Ekatta means oneness. It's equivalent to non-duality in the suttas. So it is, as you say, it is like an experience of universal consciousness. That's what it can be interpreted as when you experience those things, right? So you see it that way. And because that is your preconditioning, you think, oh, this is it, universal consciousness. Wow, I've reached the end of, I found the absolute truth. So, so it's all about conditioning. And to me, the one of the things is that the Buddhist teachings, when I read them, they are different from other teachings. They advocate something that is non-self, something that is extraordinarily different from everything else. And to me, the idea, as long as you have an idea of something which is there, an essence of consciousness, you are ballpark, roughly, where all these other spiritual practices are. When you say that consciousness comes to a complete stop, you have really, it's a radical difference from almost everything else. And that's what I read the suttas. The Buddha says, when nama rupa ceases, consciousness ceases, right? He doesn't say, when nama rupa ceases, the chit-durum arises. No, consciousness ceases. And elsewhere, it is quite clear that, the Arahant says, when I die, when I pass away, the mind too passes away. The mind kind of disappears. You say goodbye to the mind. And so I cannot see, personally, that it is much doubt about that from the sutta point of view. Okay, can you briefly explain how the five khandhas relate to the six sense fields? I find this a bit confusing. So these are, remember the Buddha teaches a reality from different points of view, just to make it more clear what is going on. So the five khandhas is one way of viewing ourselves, of viewing the world, if you like, or viewing experience. We can divide up experience in this way. So you are conscious of things, right? You perceive the world. You're able to make things out around you. You feel, there's a feeling aspect to that experience. There is a will aspect. We go out, we do things. And there is the form aspect to that experience. This is just one way of dividing up experience. There's another way you can divide up experience, and that is based on the six sense bases. Right? We see things, we hear things, we relate, we have mental experiences. So this is just another way of dividing up experience. And sometimes it can be useful to have different ways of doing that, because some people find it easier to relate to certain ways of certain teaching, a certain way of dividing it up. Other people find it easier to look at this in a different way. So these are just different ways of looking at this. The five khandhas can often seem very abstract, right? What are these five khandhas? There's a question you get a lot, I get very often. What does these five khandhas actually mean? They seem so abstract. I can't make any sense of them. Whereas the six sense bases, it's much easier in a way, right? Okay, we all know what seeing, hearing and tasting means. Whereas the five khandhas is more difficult. But an easy way to relate to the five khandhas and to understand what they are is to experience what happens in meditation practice. And as you meditate, as you become more peaceful, what is happening? That those five khandhas are starting to disappear. They are fading away. Right? That's actually what you're seeing there. So for example, you see the senses fading away, right? The senses fading away is like the form aggregate. Disappearing gradually. The perceptions and the feelings that are associated with the sensual perception, that is fading away. So these aspects of the five khandhas are disappearing. As you're becoming more peaceful, the will is fading away. There's less activity going on. You're not willing things anymore, right? And the deeper the meditation is, the more of these khandhas have disappeared or partially disappeared or faded away or whatever you like. And that's a very easy way of understanding the khandhas. You can actually see it in practice in your meditation experience. But really, all experience is just that, the five khandhas. Okay, so I hope that makes a little bit of sense. So I'll leave that for now. Okay, I have been taught two things about pain that comes up during meditation. That it is simply trapped energy being released, that it may be karmic traces having been long carried that are surfacing and leaving here. Are these views correct? It is simply energy being released. I don't know, is it energy being released? It's just pain is just one of the aspects of life. It's one of the aspects of having a physical body. Energy, I guess it depends what you mean by energy. I guess it's all a matter of definition, these things. But it is, pain is just an aspect of having a physical body. You get reborn into a human body, then you can expect a certain amount of physical pain. That's just the way it has to be with this physical body. So you can't really avoid that. I guess you can call it energy being released. I'm not really sure exactly what that would mean, but certainly it is painful. Karmic traces having been long carried that are surfacing and leaving. Again, I don't really like to think of pain as karma. It's this idea that, well, we have all this bad karma, and then by experiencing pain, somehow that karma is disappearing. I don't really think that is an accurate understanding of the Buddhist idea of karma. Karma is really more about the big picture things, right? It's about why you have been reborn into human existence. So you are a human being because you made the karma to be reborn as a human being in the past. You made karma that drove you to the sensual realm, the karma dhatu, sensual realm is this one. And you made karma also which kind of guided you to the human existence within that sensual realm. So that is really what karma does. It makes you into a human being, or it makes you into a kind of a divine existence, or maybe a ghost existence, and all these kind of things. That is kind of the main thing here. And maybe there are certain big things in life, right? You get reborn very poor and sickly, or you get reborn very wealthy and healthy, or whatever, and you're very stupid, or very intelligent, or wise, or whatever. These big issue things may also have karmic causes. But the fact that there is pain in the body, that's just what it is to be human, right? You can expect that. Human life, this is what human life does to you. And you cannot really, I don't think you can blame this on specific karmic causes in the past. And the Buddha says in the sutta that all these things that happen that have got nothing to do with karma. He says, for example, talks about illnesses. And illnesses in those days was a combination of it was considered to be a combination of bile, phlegm, and something else coming together, and that's how illnesses arose. There was an imbalance, sometimes translated as an imbalance in the bodily humors, imbalance in the bodily kind of aspects, right? That imbalance led to illness. And the Buddha says, well, that's one way why you get sick, right? You get sick because of this. Or there is the changing of the seasons, the changing of the climate. So the climate changes, it gets cold, it gets hot, or whatever. So that's life. It's got nothing to do with karma. Then there is even assault is mentioned in there. You get assaulted. The Buddha says nothing. It's not karma. Assault is just one of the things that you can also expect as a human being. And then the circumstances and nature. You walk outside, you trip on something. Is that karma? No, it's because you weren't properly attentive, there was something in the way, right? Something there. That's what you can expect in life. And then there's the eighth factor, and that is kamma vipaka, right? But so kamma is another reason why we experience things. So all of these things are reasons why we experience things in life. So pain is just, you are here, you have been born into human existence, and that was your mistake, right? Getting reborn as a human, that was where you went wrong. It wasn't by, you know, otherwise sitting down in meditation is like we are ripening all this karma by doing that. No, I don't think so. You are just experiencing the results of being human being, that's all. There's an interesting sutta about this. The Buddha talks to some Jain practitioners. This sutta is called the Devadaha Sutta. It's found in the Majjhima Nikaya, number 101. And he's having this discussion with his Jain ascetics. And these Jain ascetics, you know what the Jains are like. They, you know, sitting on burning rocks in the middle of the sun, in the middle of the day, right? Standing on one leg for 10 years and all this kind of stuff. That's what they do, right? And so then the Buddha asked, and then they claim, right, oh, we are just burning off bad karma from the past. And then the Buddha asked him, well, isn't the reason why you're experiencing pain because you're standing on one leg? Maybe that's the reason, not because you're burning off bad karma. How do you know which one is, how do you know which one is the reason? If you don't stand on one leg, you don't feel it anymore. So how can it be bad karma? And so, and this is kind of the Buddha's argument. Sometimes we do things, and these things that we do, they lead to all the suffering. Yeah. And so if you sit down cross-legged and you say, I'm going to sit like this for 2 hours, yes, you're going to feel pain. Not because you're burning off karma, but because you're sitting there like that for 2 hours. So that's why, much better than to move your position, change your position, the body can be at ease, the body can fade away, and then the meditation can happen. Remember, it is so important to be kind to ourselves, right? There's a certain harshness about forcing ourselves into sitting in a certain position. The mind, and when the mind becomes hard, there is no way you're going to have success in meditation practice. The mind has to be gentle, has to be soft. You have to have a feeling of kindness towards yourself and kindness to the people around you. That is when meditation becomes possible. So a lot of these things are about right attitude. Having the right attitude is so important in this. Okay. Okay, Dear Ajahn Brahmali, is there an interpretation of birth and rebirth, not from lifetime to lifetime, but from moment to moment as well, that there is no permanent self and our past and present karma creates our consciousness from moment to moment in a constant cycle with metta? There are people who interpret dependent arising in this way, and this view seems to come from the Abhidhamma Pitaka, where that is probably first mentioned. And what is interesting about that Abhidhamma Pitaka view, the Abhidhamma says, this is the Abhidhamma method. The Sutta method is different. The Sutta method is like this. This is the Abhidhamma method, the one which is moment to moment. So what the Abhidhamma is really saying, it seems, is that the Sutta method is one where things go across lifetimes, and it's only in the Abhidhamma where you find this other idea. So, but remember that the point here is, first of all, that the Buddha didn't teach like that. It comes from the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma makes it fairly clear that the Buddha, he taught the ordinary dependent arising, where it happens from life to life. So this is the first point here. The second point is that it is possible to take a structure. Dependent origination is like a structure of 12 links, right? You can take that structure and you can apply it to different areas. You can apply it perhaps to moment-to-moment arising, the moment-to-moment existence of mental qualities. You can apply it to that, and then you're applying an existing structure in a new way. But it's important to remember that this is a new way of applying an existing structure. It doesn't mean that dependent origination, the way it's taught by Buddha, the Buddha actually means that. And we can always do that. We can always apply things in new ways. And this is what I think has happened in history. People have applied this in new ways. And then later on we have started to think, whoa, actually maybe this is what the Buddha himself taught. And I don't think that there is any evidence for that in the suttas. Dependent origination in the suttas is all about how this samsaric process, the process of going around and around, is sustained. Right? The talks about the whole mass of suffering, and that whole mass of suffering that is created by dependent origination. Of course, when you look at the suttas, that whole mass is precisely this idea of going on and on and on. Accumulating bones as high as mountains, shedding blood and tears, you know, from life after life. This is kind of how the suttas talk about this. So, mental processes are also interesting. You can see how your mind works, in a sense. And that, of course, matters as well. The Buddha talks about that, talks about the working of the mind. And this is one of the important things for meditation practice to work, to have some idea of how your mind works. And you can see that by observing the mind. It's not called dependent origination, but it's still an interesting and important area, and it will enhance your meditation practice. Okay, a request please, Ajahn, that the daily program include a regular and morning and evening chanting. Okay. Okay, I'll think about it. I personally don't particularly into morning and evening chanting myself. So I may pass on that one. I think Ajahn Brahm probably does a little bit more of that sort of thing. But a lot of this morning and evening chanting, especially the one that is done in Thailand, I don't even find it all that inspiring, to be honest. It was composed by some king about 150 years ago, and there's all kind of weird things. If you understand the Pali, all kind of strange things going on there, which I personally don't really enjoy all that much. I find it much better to chant the Metta Sutta, which is probably the word of the Buddha, or do the Arahang maybe in the evening. That's my personal feeling about this. I'm happy to be flexible, but unless lots of people are really keen on this, I think I might pass on that one. Sorry about that. So, okay. Dear Ajahn, one, is consciousness that directs rebirth the same as the one in the five aggregates? Yes, it's the same thing, right? Consciousness is consciousness. So it is the same idea. In the directing of rebirth, it's consciousness there is, in a way, it's like mind, it's a synonym for the mind itself. Remember that these are really abstractions. There's no such thing as consciousness completely by itself. Consciousness is always comes together with other things, with feelings, with everything. Pure consciousness, there's no such thing really. It always has some object, something that it comes together with. Two, if consciousness is always there, then will it be more correct for me to understand that volitional formations or the will shapes or defines consciousness rather than to give rise to it? Yes, it is. That's true. It definitely shapes consciousness. There's two aspect thing here, independent arising. One aspect is the shaping aspect. So it kind of gives you the level and the quality of consciousness is decided by our volitional activities. This is one important part of it. But the point is also that it also actually gives rise to it as well. If there are no volitional activities, if the mind is not pointing any particular direction, if you don't want to be reborn anymore, there's no intention there, there's no volition there, no will, nothing at all to drive the consciousness forward, then the consciousness stops, right? So it also, in a sense, gives rise to it in the sense that it allows it to continue into the future. And a lot of these links and dependent arising have that twofold aspect to them. They both shape the subsequent factor and they also give rise to it. It comes kind of together in a way. Okay, thank you, Ajahn. If a stream enter has given up views of self, what have they left? Please distinguish between stream enter and the fully awakened one. I hope to be one before I die this time. Okay, wow. Well, that's really good. I'm glad you say that. So you have, there's no false modesty there. We're just going to go for it all the way. That's great. Okay, so what do they have left? And what they have left really is that even though they have a view of self, there is still, remember, the view is one thing. The view is just like an outlook on life. But that outlook has been changed. We have seen the reality, but it takes a while for kind of all the defilements and all the habits to work themselves out of your system, right? It's so deeply ingrained in the mind, so deeply ingrained in your consciousness, all the habits, all these ways of looking at things, that it takes time. Even though you look at the world in the right way, it has to work itself out. But the point is that once you are a stream enterer, all the defilements have been fatally wounded. Eventually they will pass away. Once the sense of self has been let go in that way, it means that craving no longer has any legs to stand on, and gradually it will fade away. The same thing with ill will. And eventually, even that very sense of self that is still there, apart from the view of self, also will fade away as a consequence. So this is just a matter of time. So you can still speed it up by practicing correctly, right? By keep on practicing samadhi, and then that will speed up the purification process of the mind, and you will let go of sensuality and let go of all these things much more quickly as a consequence. So basically the path from being a stream mentor to being a fully awakened one is just practicing samadhi, right? Once you're a stream mentor, samadhi becomes very easy because you have seen that there is that you are not holding on to anything anymore. Before you are a stream mentor, you think that there are certain aspects which are yourself, you are clinging on to certain things. But once you have seen through that there is no self in there, it's easy to let go. It is the view of self which makes it hard to let go. So you're able to let go of things, and that is why samadhi comes very easily to a stream mentor compared to an ordinary person. So you enter the samadhi, keep on entering the samadhi, contemplating impermanence, contemplating non-self, especially relating to that samadhi itself. And that is how you then progress on the path, seeing these five aggregates, whatever remains of them, as non-self, impermanent, problematic, as a calamity. I like this translation. There is a whole list of synonyms. This is from one of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's called the Mahamalunkya Sutta. And it's the Buddha speaking to a monk called Malunkya, I think. In this sutta, you go into a state of samadhi, right, the first jhana, something like that. And when you come out of the other end, you contemplate that jhana in terms of impermanence, suffering and non-self. And one of the adjectives used in there is that you see it as a calamity, right? So very powerful, powerful word, calamity. So these five aggregates are really a calamity here. So that's what he's saying in there. I'm not sure if it is. I think it's Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. I'm not 100% sure if it is justified from the Pali, but anyway, it's a nice translation, I reckon. Okay. Dear Ajahn, to have ignorance is to have the I am. Are the 10 fetters the foothold for consciousness to establish its identity? How does the sense of I am fade with the 4 stages of awakening? Sadhu. Big smiley face, okay. To have ignorance, is it to have the sense of I am? Yes, that's part of it, right? That's part of the idea of avidya, ignorance, to have the feeling I am. Are the 10 fetters the foothold for consciousness to establish its identity? Well, really, the foothold for consciousness to establish its identity is really the 5 khandhas, right? The 5 aggregates, that's where identity establishes itself in relation to that. The 10 fetters is just a way of looking at the defilements of the mind. So the defilements of the mind are then gradually let go of. But the sense of identity is always in relation to our experience. We experience the world, and somewhere in that experience we see I am. And that is the 5 aggregates, or the 6 sense spaces, etc., etc. How does a sense of I am fade with the 4 stages of awakening? So, first of all, you have, like we saw in the previous question, first of all, you have to abandon the view I am, right? You no longer have that view. You have seen reality. If somebody asks you, you will always deny that there is an I am. But the feeling still remains in you, because it is still that habit is still so strong, so it remains in you. Sometimes you still feel I am. You think I am. But if somebody asks you and you have a minute to think about it, you know, actually, it is not really the case. And of course, with each stage of awakening, it fades a little bit more, right? So when you become an once-returner, the I am becomes weaker, non-returner even weaker. And finally, arahantship, no more experience of I am. You don't see yourself in that way anymore. And that is why the arahants are so happy. No more I am. It sounds counterintuitive, right? But that is the way this path works. Okay. Dear Ajahn, a soldier kills an enemy to defend a nation, okay? Sharks are killed to safeguard surfers. Fishing as a sport. They catch fish, measure and return to the water. how all will all accrue karma. Okay. Okay, so what kind of karma comes from this? That's the question here. How does this work out in a karma sense, right? A soldier kills an enemy to defend a nation, right? And this is kind of part of the problem, isn't it? To defend a nation. What are we really defending? What are these nations anyway? This kind of artificial boundaries that we have created between ourselves. It's kind of weird, isn't it? What are these nations? Apparently, if you go back into history not that far long ago, there weren't really any nations. There were no boundaries. People can move around as they wanted. It's kind of this modern idea. You get a passport, okay, bang, now you are this nationality. Is it how real is it? If you travel overseas, are they not really humans overseas? Are they kind of lesser beings or something? It's a bit like that, right? I'm defending our nation because we are better. Our values are higher, so we can kill somebody else. It's a crazy idea. It's kind of this divisive idea. We're dividing up humanity into these things. This is nationalism, right? Our nation, wow, very proud of your nationality or whatever. It is really, really silly. And it is one of those, I think, terrible things, all this nationalism we see around the world. People are building up. Our nation has one powerful history. And because we have this long history, we are better than those scallywags who only have a recent history, right? That makes Australia look pretty bad in things recent. But actually, we could argue Aboriginal culture, right? Goes back 50,000 years or whatever. So maybe in one way, where it's even more ancient in Australia. Whatever. These are the kind of ideas people have. So of course, you are really killing somebody to defend the nation. You're killing somebody else based on a delusion, really. There's nothing really there. You're killing another human being. It doesn't matter if you are defending a nation or not. Of course, you could argue that in this case, perhaps you are with an army and you happen to be a soldier and you don't really want to kill anybody. You get pushed into this position. And of course, if you do get pushed into that position, then there is less intention inside of you. A lot of it is coming from the outside. It is still bad karma, but not as bad karma as if you voluntarily go out and start killing people on your own. That, of course, is much worse. So there are degrees here, and you have to look at the intention of the person to really decide on how bad the karma is. But some people are very happy to defend the nation. They go around killing all these barbarians overseas, right? And maybe that is not such a good idea. Anyway, sharks are killed to safeguard surfers. Okay, that is an interesting one. So again, it is kind of, in this case, you really are safeguarding somebody's life, right? The sharks really are a menace, and there is a real problem there. This kind of karma, when you kill sharks to safeguard a surfer, I mean, I guess it really depends on the situation. But you know, if a shark, for example, a shark actually is attacking somebody, right, and they might die, and then you have a chance to kill the shark, then what kind of karma is that? And this kind of it really depends on where you are coming from. If you are coming from compassion for this poor surfer who might die as a consequence, but you don't really want to kill the shark, but you see no way out, then of course the karma is not going to be very bad. But if you see this, how this is my opportunity to kill a shark, it's good fun to kill a shark, of course, in that case, the karma is worse, right? So it all depends on intention, motivation. What is driving you? What is the force behind this? The best thing, of course, is not to kill any of these beings. That's the ideal thing. But sometimes our societies are so complex, it can make it very difficult. Fishing as a sport. They catch the fish, measure and return to water. I think that's fine, right? If you just catch the fish and you measure them and then put them back to water, no problem at all. You're just doing some little bit of scientific investigation or whatever. Fishing as a sport, you're killing fish because you enjoy the thrill of fishing. I don't think that's a very good idea at all. Your thrill is somebody else's suffering. That's basically what's happening. I used to fish as well when I was a very long time ago now. But when I think back, it's not very nice at all. You know, all these beings, they are suffering because you are kind of enjoying the fishing itself. So if we're going to enjoy ourselves, let's enjoy ourselves in harmless ways, not in ways that causes suffering for other beings. But it's very complicated, because everything in the end depends on your intention. You have to look back at the intention of the person, and that is ultimately what decides whether karma is good or bad. Okay. Dear Ajahn, past karma has resulted in the present moment. The present moment is where we are making our future karma. If we only have very little free will in the present moment to make our future karma, then that is almost getting close to fatalism, where we are puppets from some unknown force. Please help resolve this confusion in my mind. Okay, with metta. Okay. Yes, but the point here really is that it doesn't feel like you are a puppet. It feels like you have a degree of free will, right? And it is precisely because it feels like you have free will that is why your mind is colored by your actions. You feel, I am doing this, and that's why you are creating karma, right? And you have no choice in that matter. You have no choice precisely because it feels like your will is free. So whether there is fatalism or not is kind of irrelevant. The point is that this is how things work. You do an act, you feel responsible, and then that colors your mind. That's what's going on. So you have to deal with that reality rather than to deal with some kind of philosophical position. The philosophical position is really irrelevant. Ask yourself instead, what actually is going on? And then that is what we deal with. And what actually is going on is that I feel like I have free will. Because of that, my actions affect my mind. And because of that, I can actually do something to affect my mind in a positive way. So you do good acts because it does affect you in a good way. You avoid the bad ones because they affect you in a bad way. And then you make progress on the path. Yes? That is really. So we have to be pragmatic about this. The problem with philosophy, it can often just lead to a lot of thinking. But let's actually look at what really happens in our lives. And then what the exact philosophical position ultimately is, it is not so important than actually getting the work out of the way, getting it done. Okay. Dear Venerable Ajahn, thank you very much for your marvelous explanation of the Lord Buddha Suttas. The explanations are fantastic. My question is, when the consciousness cannot exist without Namarupa, what form does the being in the Antarabhava take with metta? Happy in the Happy Sutta retreat. Okay, there's a smiley face and then the arrow saying happy in the Happy Sutta retreat. Okay, good. Okay, so that's good. So what form does the being in the Antarabhava? The Antarabhava is the intermediate existence. Antara means between. Bhava means existence, the between existence. So what form does it take? And the form is just like the form that like what we have now, right? It's a kind of slightly different from an ordinary human being. It's more like a spirit being. But remember, a spirit being isn't that different from us. They say in the suttas that when you can draw your mind-made body out of your physical body, has exactly the same faculties, the same kind of limbs as you have now. You are basically the same. It's like drawing one body out of another one. But of course, it is a different type of materiality. It's not the coarse materiality we have now. It's a lighter form of materiality. So you feel slightly different. But basically, the five khandhas are still there. There's still some kind of materiality there. You still have perception, you still have feelings, you have consciousness, you have will. All these aspects are still part of existence, even in the Antarabhava. And then you move into a new existence. Remember, some of these existences that we get reborn into are also quite different from human existence, right? If you get born into a jhana realm, wow, it's absolutely different from what we have here. And a lot of the things that we experience here cannot be experienced there. It's a different, the five aggregates are very different there. These five aggregates are very malleable. They can take lots of different shapes, right? They are there in the Antarabhava. They are there upon rebirth. They are there here in our ordinary human existence. Okay. So, there you are. So Nama Rupa is still there in the Antara Bhava. Dear Bhante, what is the difference between revulsion and repulsion? Having enough and ill will, just hating everything, okay? Yeah, I would not, don't hate everything. That is really a bad idea. What does the difference feel like? Okay, so I think the best way, the way I always have liked to describe this, the feeling of revulsion and repulsion, right? You are repelled by something. Revulsion is a very strong word, but repulsion might be better because it is a little bit more kind of being repelled by something may not be quite as strong. I'm not sure. People have different relationship to words. I'm not sure about that. But one way of looking at this is imagine yourself. You are in your house. Your cooktop is there. There's a hot plate on the cooktop. You're not aware that the hot plate has recently been used, right? So you put your hand on it by accident, but it has recently been used. It's really hot. Now, if you do that, what happens? You don't have to think, should I remove my hand or not, right? Sure, should I remove it? Not. It's automatic. You just withdraw it straight away. It happens by itself, right? It just happens. And this is like repulsion. It's like it's a kind of aversion, but not an aversion that has anything to do with ill will. Nothing that has anything to do with hating everything. You just withdraw it because you know this is going to be painful. It's an automatic reaction. And it's exactly the same thing that happens with the mind. When you see dukkha, it's exactly like seeing the dukkha on the hot plate. When you see dukkha, the mind turns away. The mind is not interested anymore. The mind is repelled by it and moving in a different direction. That is the difference. It's an automatic mechanism in the mind that happens automatically. It just withdraws from those things that it considers dukkha. So real insight means a withdrawal from those things in the world that are painful and problematic. So that is repulsion. That is this word, nibbida. Aversion is another way of translating it. Disenchantment is another translation, but I think it's a bit too weak. You're not disenchanted with the hot plate. You're actually literally, you know, kind of repelled by it. So that is the difference. So be very careful. Remember that sometimes when you teach this Buddhist teachings, it may sound like you're supposed to hate everything, right? Oh, everything ends in suffering. Everything is bad. You know, you get this nice car, this nice Ferrari, and then you have to give it up again. Or relationships that end in death. Whoa, all this woe and suffering. How terrible everything is. But please don't take this the wrong way. Remember, this is just a way of learning to reflect on the world, to think about things in a different way. We are always attracted to these things, right? We think these things are marvelous. Most people think these things are, whoa, it's so wonderful, all of these things. But there is a downside. And the Buddha is telling us, well, look at the downside as well. Because when you understand both the upside and the downside, then you can make rational decisions about what to do with this. So it's not about learning how to hate things. It's just learning to reflect in a new way. Wait a minute. Maybe there's another way of looking at this, right? So please don't go around hating all of these things. That would be a very bad outcome. It's more a way of reflecting, to think about the world in a certain way. And that will actually affect you. It will affect your meditation. It will affect your whole life. If you understand that the body is problematic, that the body always leads to pain and suffering, and that, you know, it's never really reliable. You get sick, you have to take it to the doctor, eventually you get old or whatever. After a while, you get slightly fed up with this body. And that's very useful in meditation practice, because it means that when you sit down, you watch the breath or whatever, you can let go of that body much more easily. If you see just a little bit of the disadvantages in the sensory world with the five senses, just a little bit, it means that when you try to follow the breath and you want to abandon the five senses, it is much more easy to do that. So it has great benefits, right? It allows you to go deeper into your meditation experience. And this is the purpose of these things. It's not to hate everything. It's actually just to help you in your meditation practice. So allow these things to happen naturally. Don't force them. Don't start hating your husband or wife, right? Oh, I really hate my husband now. The Buddha said, husband is no good, or wife is no good. Please don't do that. That's the wrong way. It's just a way of learning how to think about things. And gradually, that wisdom will slowly, slowly grow. It shouldn't be something that you force. It should happen by itself. And when it happens by itself, it becomes very powerful. Okay. Dear Ajahn, if a person does bad things, believing that the acts are good, will this person go to a higher realm after death? From this person's point of view, this person has been accumulating good karma. If you really do bad things, believing that they are good, it means you are deluded. You don't know what's going on. That's what it really means, right? If you think that, killing people and is great because they deserve to die or whatever, right? This kind of stuff. If you really believe that, it doesn't really matter. It will still drag you down if you go around killing people. The only way that you can't really do bad things with bad intentions and actually reap good results. It's impossible if your intentions actually are bad. If you're driven by anger, driven by greed, driven by delusion, it doesn't matter whether you think it's good or not. Everybody thinks what they're doing is good, right? If you ask somebody who steals something or kill somebody, they will always have a reason why they did that. They will always justify it in a certain way. In one way, they think what they did was good. Mass murderers think that they do the right thing, right? But that doesn't make it right just because they justify it in a certain way. Everybody justifies their actions. What you have to look at is their intention. Are the intentions pure? If the intentions are pure, fine. If the intentions are not pure, then there is a problem and the act actually is bad. And this is problematic, right? It means that lots of people are trapped in delusion in this world, trapped by their own outlook, and they can't really get out because that's what they think. This is how they think about the world, right? You grow up in the kind of the wrong family with the wrong friends and the wrong nation, the wrong kind of ideology, and you get trapped by that ideology, by that way of looking at the world. You grow up in this mafia family and they tell you killing is good, right? Get rid of these people and whatever. And gangsters, there are gangsters everywhere around the world. And of course, if you grow up with those ideas, you can get trapped by those ideas. And this is a very important point, because delusion in the mind is something which comes and goes. So you should be very happy once you are kind of heading in the right way. Delusion is starting to go down. Take the opportunity. This is why one reason why the opportunity to practice the Buddhist path, it comes around so rarely, right? Now it is here. Now you have the opportunity. Now you're seeing things slightly in the right way. That's what we think anyway, right? We think that we're not deluded now. We think we're heading in the right direction. Hopefully that's the case. I think it is the case. So let's take that opportunity. Let's use it now. You don't know when you will be conditioned in the wrong way, heading in the wrong direction again in the future. Now is the chance. Now is the opportunity to gain clarity and understanding. So this gives you a sense of urgency, right? Now we have to do it. And that's why it is so wonderful to be able to be here at Dharma Grove and do some meditation practice and learn a bit more about Dhamma and how to cultivate the mind, etc. Okay. Next one. Help! I am just now realizing how stuck I am in my head. I seem to spend most of my time rehashing the past or fantasizing about things. Any tips to get me out of my head? Okay. Okay, so the way to do that is always to understand that not being stuck in your head actually is a much more happy and contented experience than being stuck in your head, right? This is really the crucial issue. And you have to start to see that. You have to start to feel those moments when the mind is peaceful. One of the things that you will find is that almost everybody has times when the mind calms down and you feel a bit more peaceful. And look for those moments between the fantasies, between the rehashing of the past, right? When the mind is relatively quiet. What does it feel like? And once you start to see that this actually is a very pleasurable and very nice experience, it tends to expand and it tends to become more, you get more of that after a while. So this is the whole clue, in a sense, to Buddhist meditation. You see this in the suttas everywhere. And the Buddha says you have to give rise to this gladness, this joy, right? This spiritual gladness, not the gladness that is based on sensual pleasure, but the joy that is based on living a good life, living a life of generosity, understanding the Dhamma, that kind of joy, that kind of happiness. This is called spiritual happiness, and it's different from the worldly happiness. And once you kind of start tapping into that kind of happiness, that is when it becomes so much easier to stay in the present moment. Because the present moment really is happy, right? You feel good about yourself. And those fantasies, they are just an obstacle for experiencing that happiness. So they tend to fall by the wayside almost automatically. And this is where you start to understand that this idea of the spiritual life is a very integrated thing. Everything you do in life will affect your meditation practice. If you can generally live a good life to the maximum, it will affect your mind enormously. It will affect your fantasizing, all of these things. So we have to make everything part of our spiritual life. And when you do that, things start to come together and they start to work out. So you have to, basically what you have to find your happiness somewhere else rather than in fantasizing. That's really what it comes down to. So, but don't use force, right? Force doesn't work. Force is not really going to happen here. So just sit back and observe. Sit back and observe your fantasies. Allow them to roam on. And after a while, perhaps you just get fed up with all those fantasies. And perhaps you want to, you know, okay, enough of all this nonsense. This is my opportunity to be here at Jhana Grove. And I just enjoy the place. If I fantasize, I'm not really enjoying the place. I'm not here. I'm somewhere else, right? My body is here. My mind is somewhere else. So take this opportunity to enjoy this. And then when you start to think like that, gradually you kind of pull your mind into the present moment. But this is one of the classic hindrances, right? What almost everybody has to some extent. Too much thinking, too much mind roaming around everywhere. This is one of the very difficult things to overcome. And often it takes time. And you have to be very patient with things. And gradually you overcome these things. Okay. Oh, ha ha, okay. okay, now we know how to address our husbands. Okay, that was the one about Lord this morning. Okay, so here is somebody who is now going to change the way you are talking to your husband. No, I don't think so, because ha ha, I think means you're not going to change. That's definitely what it means. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? Okay. Good. So, we'll leave that one to one side. Okay. Dear Bhante, is DN15 saying that consciousness and form go hand in hand? That once consciousness passes from one life to another, immediately after death, and there's no in-between state like the bardo in Tibetan Buddhism. Thank you. I don't think that is what it is saying. I think the Digha Nikaya 15, the Mahanidana Sutta that we had a look at today, it is just saying that form, the material and psychological aspects of human existence, they can only exist and grow and develop, at least from a certain point onwards, when consciousness is present. That's really, I think, all it is saying. I don't think it is saying anything about whether there is an intermediate state or not. In fact, to me, when I read the suttas, I have seen a lot of places where it looks to me that the evidence is very strong that there is such a thing as an intermediate existence. I'm not going to read those out because it gets very technical and boring. I don't think there's any point in reading those passages out, but they are there in the suttas. There is actually one sutta which comes later on. Maybe tomorrow we'll have a look at that sutta, which talks a little bit about something that looks a bit like an intermediate existence. We can have a look at that tomorrow. So I would say, no, I don't think that. I know that this is the traditional Theravadan idea, is that there is no intermediate existence. But I can't really see exactly how that is justified. And there are other schools of Buddhism where certainly the intermediate existence is accepted. But it's kind of, you know, kind of whatever in a sense, I suppose, because even if there is an intermediate existence, it's almost like a life in between, right? A short life in between, and you can, I mean, there's different ways of looking at this anyway. So, I think the most important thing to me is that it matches with the ideas and the experiences that many people have, near-death experience. It matches very well with that, the idea of an intermediate existence. And that's why I think it, another reason why I think it makes good sense. Okay. Next one, in Digha Nikaya 15, when it says, if those qualities, traits, signs and indicators through which there is a description of the material body were absent, is it referring to our eyes, ears, nose, etc., or to the external object, sight, sounds, etc.? It is referring to, in this case, it is referring to the eyes, yes, the eyes and the ear, the nose, right? There is a description for the material body. We're here talking about the five khandhas as relating to ourselves. So that is the main thing that it is referring to. Our ability to contact the world. Our ability depends on the presence of the of these material faculties, in a sense. It's a curious thing, right? Those qualities, traits, signs and indicators through which there is a description of the material body. It's a very roundabout way of saying the senses or the material body. Why does the Buddha talk in this way here? It's fascinating. Why does it say? Why does it say that? Why does it say straight away if there is no material body here? And I think the reason is because our knowledge of the material body, our knowledge of the mind, our knowledge of anything is because it has certain qualities. There are certain ways that it makes itself known, right? Body, okay, there's a certain hardness, right? This is body right here. This is how we know the body is there. But we only know it through that. We cannot really say anything about the body inherently existing in its own right. All we know it through these signs, indications. And the same thing with the mental body. The mind is known through certain indications, right? Certain internal feelings. And the idea, I think, is perhaps that we're not talking about something inherently existing in its own right. We're just talking about something that exists or seems to exist because we have all these signs and indications that something is there or we are experiencing something. Something like that, I think, is the reason for that. To show that it is something that we are aware of, but not necessarily has any inherent existence beyond that. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, can someone who does not know Buddhism much, but meditate to reach samadhi? Indeed, certainly. Samadhi is one of those things that almost anyone can reach, regardless of what kind of background you have. You know, you don't really have to be a Buddhist. You can be a Christian, a Muslim, an atheist. You can be almost anything. As long as you have a good heart, you are a kind-hearted person, you have the right attitude, samadhi can be reached. It is really beyond samadhi where things get problematic, because beyond samadhi, your conditioning, the views that you bring into that experience will then decide how you deal with that, how you interpret the experience. Right, that is when it gets really problematic. But samadhi itself, as long as you have virtue, as long as you are kind, you have a good heart, then samadhi is possible because of that. That is really all that matters. But you have to be really, really, really virtuous to gain samadhi. And this is what is so hard. You have to be really, have a very good heart, right? And this is what we're talking about, all these ideas about having the right attitude. You have to have this attitude of, you know, being generous to everyone, or being kind to everybody, wanting to do the right thing. Is this, you know, this is really what makes meditation possible at the end of the day. As I was reading out the first sutta on the first day, talking about the process of meditation, it all starts with sila, which is basically our habits, our virtues, our conduct, our behavior, who we are as human beings. Our character is really what it refers to. Huh? So you want to have a very pure character. Very pure character gives rise to samadhi. Huh? All right. So we have been going for almost 1 hour now. I'll just go through the last ones as well fairly quickly and see what shouldn't take too long, I think. Yeah. Dear Ajahn, is consciousness one thing that develops into a name and form, or are they separate, coming together in the womb? So, in reality, these things all come together, and they come together in one thing called experience, right? Experience is really one package coming together, and in that experience you find consciousness, you find perception, feeling, you find form. They all come together in experience. But for purposes of showing how this process works, we divide things up into consciousness on the one hand, and name and form on the other. It doesn't develop from one to the other one. This is a conditional relationship. One conditions the other one. It causes the other one to exist. It gives shape to the other one, a certain shape to it, but does not develop from one to the other one. So they come. You can say they come together. That's as a way of looking at it. All of these things come together. Yes, I hope that makes sense. If not, please, you can maybe rephrase the question again, if you like. Yeah. Dear Ajahn, if consciousness is the condition for Nama Rupa, does it mean that the moon doesn't exist until I look at or think about it? Is that what it means? What is missing in the sequence of dependent origination in an arahant? Lots of metta. Does it mean that the moon doesn't exist until I look at it or think about it? Well, the moon is really an experience, right? It's something that you experience in reality. So the experience of the moon doesn't exist until you look at it. That's for sure, right? The experience is only there when you look at the moon. Whether the moon exists in its own or not is kind of irrelevant. Who cares if the moon exists? That's the way I think about it. It doesn't really matter if the moon exists out there as an independent entity. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I don't actually know. This is all very philosophical and very hard to figure out. But what I do know is that the experience of moon only is there when I look at the moon or I think about the moon. Most of the time I don't, so most of the time I don't have the experience of moon. So that is the important part, because it is experience that we are dealing with. It is experience that matters. That is where we feel dukkha and sukha. That's where there are problems. That's where there are solutions. Experience is what it comes back to. The universe out there is kind of an unknown, right? We don't really, it kind of doesn't really matter so much. So I try to be pragmatic about this, not to get caught up in philosophizing, because then we can be here forever just talking about stuff, and then we die before we finish talking, and we didn't get anywhere on the path. Okay, so what is missing in the sequence of dependent origination in the arahant? What is missing is avijja. At the very beginning, the arahant has seen there's no more avijja, there's no more delusion, right? Delusion has passed away. And because delusion has passed away, you are no longer creating these sankharas, these activities, willed activities, that color consciousness. So consciousness isn't being colored anymore. Consciousness is not standing anything. Consciousness isn't pointing towards any particular realm, because it has no interest in that anymore. So all of that has fallen away. What has also fallen away in the arahant is, after feeling, after Vedana, you have craving, right? Craving stops, because when you see things as they really are, there is no interest anymore in creating anything, so you don't crave for anything anymore. When you don't crave for anything, you have no upadana, you don't grasp all this kind of stuff, you don't hold on to all kind of things, and you don't exist in any particular way. Your consciousness is not stuck in a particular realm, at a particular level, where you do certain things because your consciousness is stuck there. So these factors, which are called craving, attachment and existence are roughly the same as the factor which is called avidya and sankhara, delusion and creative activities. There are two ways of looking at the same thing here. This is the beauty of dependent arising. It gives you two ways or different ways of looking at the same issue, basically. Makes it very, very broad. So all of that is missing, right? And because that is missing, because the consciousness is not established in anything, it means it doesn't go anywhere after when you pass away. Okay. Dear Ajahn Ramali, I have heard from a famous monk a story about a Buddhist woman who was dying. He asked the nurse not to give drugs to reduce the pain because it might cloud the mind. And also he said, our last thought before the death could affect for the next life. I've heard from Ajahn Ram, even somebody has dementia before the death, their mind cleared by itself. These are my memories. If not correct, please forgive me. Could you please tell us about your opinion about this? Yes, I'd be very happy to do that. And my opinion is that I have exactly the same thing that Ajahn Brahm. In fact, there is a book in our library in the monastery which is called Irreducible Mind, a very interesting book. And it has all about all these phenomena, strange phenomena that are not really explainable by a materialist, ordinary materialistic science, the science that we have in the present day. And one of those strange phenomena which is mentioned in that book, which apparently is quite well known among doctors and people who care for the elderly, is that sometimes when somebody who has very severe dementia, who doesn't recognize anybody, no idea what's going on, suddenly, just before they die, the mind clears up and they say, Mom, or dad, or maybe children, probably more likely if you have dementia, son, daughter, friends, whatever, how are you? I'm dying, I'm out of here. Okay, and they die, right? Something like that. So they have this clarity just before they die. Suddenly they start seeing what's going on, and it's very hard to explain this from an ordinary physiological point of view, because the brain is completely destroyed. There's nothing left in the brain. But from a Buddhist point of view, it actually makes very good sense, because when you get very close to the point of death, you are starting to detach from the physical body. The mind is starting to separate from the sick brain, right? And of course, as that separation happens, clarity starts to return, because you are no longer confined to that ill brain and that bad body which is causing all the problems for you. And this shows you, in a sense, that this idea that the body or the brain is like a filter for the mind is actually quite a good way of thinking about the brain. Once you are released from that filter, if the filter gets damaged, the mind also seems damaged, because it can't really see through it properly anymore. Once you're released from that damaged filter, things become clear again. So I think that it is, I would have to agree, I think that this idea that we shouldn't take drugs when we die, we should be careful because we should have clarity, we shouldn't cloud the mind. Personally, I feel all of that is a little bit overdone, because the moment you die, clarity comes back anyway. If you force yourself to die with lots of pain, chances are you will have a bit of ill will and aversion, right? All this pain. You don't want to have ill will and aversion as you're dying. I think it's better to calm, have compassion and kindness for yourself. Use those drugs. Okay, so your mind is cloudy. But as soon as you are released from the body, mindfulness returns anyway. So it's not really an issue. That would be my view of that. And that's how I tend to regard it. I don't think it's such a good idea to go through lots of pain just because you don't want to cloud the mind at that point. Okay, anyway, there you are. You've got my opinion. Just a few more questions. If one of the five precepts mentioned about abstaining from killing living creatures, does it not include consumption of dead creatures? After all, it's your desire that has caused their death. Okay, so this is the standard kind of view about being vegetarians or not, right? This is presumably the point of this. So does it include the consumption of dead creatures? Well, I think the point is that when you The actual act of killing is quite powerful, right? When you are acting to specifically to kill a creature, you have the gun in your hand and you want to shoot a kangaroo or whatever, there's something about that which has a very powerful impact on the mind. That act of killing itself has a powerful impact. Whereas the act of just eating meat or buying it in the shop, yes, you, of course, somebody, the animal has to be killed, etc. But I don't think it has the same impact on you when you buy the meat in a shop as when you actually actively kill somebody. I think there is actually quite a big difference there. You need to be much harder, much more callous, much more insensitive to be able to shoot an animal. I remember when I was 16 years old, somebody had given me an air gun, right? One of these air guns with little things. And I remember I was messing around with one of my friends and we were kind of aiming at this bird. We didn't really want to kill this bird. We were just having some, you know, some kind of aiming at something. And I remember I hit this bird, right? That wasn't really what I wanted to do at all. And I felt so terrible about it. It felt absolutely terrible when you actually hit this living creature. It didn't even die from it. It kind of just fell off the tree and sort of whatever. But I felt very, very bad about that. It had a very powerful impact, that feeling that you have hurt another creature like that. You can almost see the bird, right? Oh, this is a terrible pain or problem. And that, at least to me, in my personal experience, has much more impact emotionally than just eating meat. I still think being vegetarian is great. I think it's a really good thing to do, because certainly, you know, if you are vegetarian, you are, you know, you are kind of doing something positive for creatures, and less animals will have to die because you're not eating so much meat. So that's wonderful to be vegetarian. I would never suggest to somebody that they shouldn't be vegetarian, but I think there's a big difference between actively killing and just eating dead animals. Okay. Dear Ajahn, can you please explain again the second paragraph of the Kacchanagata Sutta? Okay, maybe not right now, if you don't mind, because it might get a little bit too involved. But I'll put it to one side, and maybe we can do it if we have a bit more time one of these days. Because it probably take too much time at this particular point. Okay, dear Ajahn, it's documented in the Jataka stories how Buddha Gautama, then a hermit who rescues an evil prince, Devadatta, and three animals from a flood. And these were the snake was Venerable Sariputta, the rat was Mahamoggallana, and the parrot was Ananda, so three animals. Animals showed gratitude to the hermit by showing a hidden treasure. But the wicked prince tries to have the hermit executed. Question, is it easy to get back to human realm once you are in the animal realm? Okay, with metta. It really depends how you get reborn in the animal realm, whether it's easy to get back or not. Sometimes you might get reborn there a little bit by accident, right? You get reborn in the animal realm because you've done a few bad things and your mind has kind of gone a little bit astray, but your general karma underneath that is very strong. So you get reborn in the animal realm for a short time and then you become a human again. That can happen. But most of the time when people get reborn in the animal realm is because they have made quite a lot of bad karma. And they haven't got that backup of good karma behind there. And if you do that, then the chances are you will be stuck in the animal realm for a very, very long time in the future. And this is one of those similes in the suttas you find in the Majjhima Nikaya 129, the Vala Pandita Sutta, the wise and the fools. And it says in there, I'm not sure how literally this is to be taken, but it says that it is like this famous simile of the blind turtle which comes to the surface of the ocean every 100 years, and the chances of that blind turtle sticking its head through a yoke floating on the ocean is roughly the same chance that you have once you are reborn as an animal, the chance of coming back to the human realm again. So it's very small. Once you get stuck in the animal realm, it's a sticky place, that's what it means, and it's hard to kind of get out of it again. So it's very good to avoid that in the first place, because once you're there, you might get you get sidetracked massively. And also, you can't really do very much, right? If you're an animal, what can you do? Can't do anything. All you can do is kind of, you know, what animals do. You can't really practice anything or do anything good. And these stories in the Jatakas about the animals who kind of, sometimes you read a story about animals who make merit. I would take those stories with a very big pinch of salt, because frankly, I don't think that really is usually how it works. Maybe if you are a monkey or some higher animal, you can actually do acts of merit. But generally speaking, as an animal, you're quite stuck in samsara. Okay, so that is a slightly longer session than usual. Please forgive me if I have kept you too long, but that's it for tonight. And we'll see you again tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. Yeah.